welcome to the Unitarian Church in Dublin. Every now and again, we have somebody from the congregation who leads the service. Now, the situation we're in now is that Bridget, our minister, has retired. And at the moment, we are waiting on the, we are waiting for Gavin Byrne after various procedures to join us. And in the meantime, members of the congregation, like myself, my name is Paul Murray, will take over leading the service. You are all extremely welcome here today, particularly if you are a visitor. If you're just popping in and think you're in University Church, you're very welcome to stay. And indeed, if you are a regular, if you're watching us on the webcam, or indeed if you are listening to us later on. Today, we welcome Shari and Fergus and Mel for their lovely music. And just to say that in Unitarian churches around the world, a candle is lit every Sunday. And the idea of the candle is to illustrate our appreciation of the fact that we can worship, if we want to use that word, but that we can attend church without hindrance or without discrimination. And we light the candle as a flame to indicate that what we are trying to do here, and I emphasize trying, is to give ourselves a spiritual path or some way of looking at this life beyond what we see immediately in front of us. Let us spend this time together to reflect on how fortunate we are to live in a country which, despite its many problems, and perhaps pending problems, we are in a peaceful situation and generally, I hasten to say, generally comfortable. And let us hope that we will continue to welcome people with whom we do not necessarily agree, provided their views are expressed rationally and sincerely and are not hurtful to any minority or vulnerable community. Our first hymn is number 1, May Nothing Evil Cross Thy Door. First reader is Chris Quinn.
Hi, folks. I'm going to be reading a short story called The Egg by Andy Weir. It just reminds me that everybody is kind of like me and that we all have the capacity for good and evil. You were on your way home when you died. It was a car accident, nothing remarkable, but fatal nonetheless. You left behind a wife and 2 children. It was a painless death. The EMTs tried their best to save you, but to no avail. And that's when you met me? What happened, you asked. Where am I? You died, I said matter-of-factly, no point in mincing words. There was a truck and it was skidding. Yep, I said. I died? You did, but don't feel bad about it. Everyone dies. You looked around. There was nothingness, just you and me. What is this place, you asked. The afterlife? More or less, I said. Are you God, you asked. Yep, I replied. I am God. My kids, my wife... What about them? Will they be all right? That's what I like to see. You just died and your main concern is for your family. You looked at me with fascination. To you, I didn't look like God. I looked like some man, or possibly woman, some vague authority figure, more of a grammar school teacher than an almighty being. Don't worry, I said. They'll be fine. Oh, you said, so what happens now? Do I go to heaven or hell? Neither. You'll be reincarnated. So the Hindus were right. All religions are right in their way. I said, walk with me. You followed along as we strode through the void. Where are we going? Nowhere in particular, I said. It's just nice to walk while we talk. So what's the point then, you asked? When I get reborn, I'll be a blank slate. Right, a baby. So all my experiences and everything I did in this life won't matter. Not so, I said. You have within you the knowledge and experiences of all your past lives. You just don't remember them right now. I stopped walking and took you by the shoulders. Your soul is more magnificent, beautiful, and gigantic than you can possibly imagine. A human mind can only contain a tiny fraction of what you are. It's like sticking your finger in a glass of water to see if it's hot or cold. You put a tiny part of yourself into the vessel, and when you bring it back out, you've gained all the experiences it had. How many times have I been reincarnated then? Oh, lots and lots, and to lots of different lives. This time around, you'll be a Chinese peasant girl in 540 AD. Wait, what? You stammered. You're sending me back in time. Well, I guess technically, time as you know it only exists in your universe. It's different where I come from. Where you come from, you said. Oh, sure, I explained. I come from somewhere else, and there are others like me. I know you'll want to know what it's like there, but honestly, you wouldn't understand yet. Oh, you said, a little let down, but wait. If I get reincarnated to other places and times, I could have interacted with myself at some point. Sure, it happens all the time. And with both lives only aware of their own, you don't even know what's happening. So what's the point of it all? Seriously, I asked. Seriously, you're asking me the meaning of life. Isn't that a little stereotypical? Well, it's a reasonable question. You persisted. I look you in the eye. The meaning of life, the reason I made this whole universe, is for you to mature. You mean mankind? You want us to mature? No, just you. I made this whole universe for you. With each new life, you grow and mature and become larger and greater intellect. Just me. What about everyone else? There is no one else, I said. In this universe, there's just you and me. You stared blankly at me, but all the people on Earth, all you, different reincarnations of you. Wait, I'm everyone? Now you're getting it, I said, with a congratulatory slap on the back. I'm every human being who ever lived, or who will live, yes. I'm Abraham Lincoln, and you were John Wilkes Booth too, I added. I'm Hitler, you said, appalled. Yes, and all the millions he killed. You fell silent. Every time you victimize someone, I said, you are victimizing yourself. Every act of kindness you've done to yourself. Every happy and sad moment ever experienced by a human was or will be experienced by you. You thought for a long time. Why, you asked me, why do all this? Because someday you will become like me, because that's where you, what you are. That's, you're one of my kind. You're my child. Whoa, you said, incredulous. You mean I'm a god? Not yet. You're a baby. You're still growing. Once you've lived every human life throughout all time, you will have grown enough to be born. So the whole universe, you asked, it's just an egg, I answered. Now it's time to move on to your next life.
If we could move to the back of our books. And say what is the doctrine of our church. Love is the doctrine of our church. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Our second hymn is number 23, Bring Many Names. The story I'm going to tell you now is about a king and queen who lived many years ago, in the island of Politiciano. Now, most of you will know where Politiciano is. If you look at a map of Europe and you look at Greece and you look right, about 450 kilometres. And this particular island has perhaps about 57,000 people, which is quite interesting because that's the same number as are in Greenland, President Trump's favourite island. And it's, so it's bigger than Leitrim anyway, let's put it. And this island's ruler was King Zeno and his not-so-lovely wife, Phobia, who thought only of themselves and their children. In fact, they didn't really like anybody, even their own subjects. Everyone, as far as they were concerned, was rude, ungrateful, smelly, ugly, untrustworthy, particularly their slaves. And as Phobia used to say, you couldn't even put your granny down and she'd be stolen. And truth be told, the king and queen didn't really like each other very much. But what brought them together? They went to the wedding of the Pharaoh Ramses, his 23rd wedding. And what brought them together with great intensity was they realized they both hated foreigners and only met them if they had to. And I should have said that they had two children, Cara and Mio, who they loved in so far as Zena and Phobia could love anybody. And one morning after the clocks changed, Phobia woke up suddenly and started nagging at Zeno. She said, he was still slumbering, of course, he never got up till 2 o'clock. We have to get a husband for Cara, he said. No one wants her, and even if they did, all the young men are horrible and poor. So we'll have to try the other islands and the other countries, and we've no choice. She's just 14, and if we don't do something, she'll be left on the shelf. In other words, nobody will want to marry her. And in those days, of course, people didn't live very long, so you had to marry very early, okay? And what about Mio? Asked her yawning husband. Anyway, he said, I want you to wait till I've had breakfast. He had loved breakfast ever since the King of Munster, Peter O'Mahony, had sent him a case of Barry's tea. And so he did that to mark their first year surviving marriage, each other, and lion's tea. Now, we need to get him married off as quick as we can to get the dowry, said Zeno. But, said Phobia, he's only interested in fencing ever since we sent him to Mount Olympus to learn fencing. And we still haven't paid, said Phobia, for Cara in Alexandra in Egypt. And they are not getting any money until we find she has a proper husband. Maybe, said Phobia, they could fall in love. Don't be silly, woman, he said. People like us don't fall in love. There'd be absolute chaos. Well, maybe they could pretend to be in love like they do in Ireland, she said, in Cork and places like that to get land. We can't do that, he said. What we need to do is we need to go, and I know you don't want to, but we need to go to Greece, where all the intelligent people, the philosophers and all of these people are. So anyway, off they went to Greece, and they got terribly seasick because they had the army with them, they had the slaves with them, and they were getting sick, and the slaves had to clean them and wash them down and everything. And eventually they arrived at night and they were taken up a big, big mountain surrounded by burning torches. And they were led through a black forest to the palace of King Tantalus, son of the god Zeus. We are here, said Zeno, for your advice on getting spouses for our children. We want Cara to marry Minamoon. But she trembles when she hears the name. And we want Mio to marry Mia, but he rants that she's too foreign for him. So we came to you as you are famous for wanting things. Oh, you foolish politiciano king, said Tantalus. It is for wanting and not getting I'm famous. Did they not tell you anything before you came here? Who are your advisors? Did you not know that I was tormented? I was punished by the gods because I told their secrets. And I was made stand in a pool of water and with fruit above me. And I couldn't reach the fruit and I couldn't bend down to drink the water. So you've come to the wrong king, he said. If you knew anything about love, you would have gone to Venus, the Unitarian goddess of love. But then, of course, she would have been no use to you, as I'm sure you dislike Romans even more than you dislike Greeks. So, he said, I'd go back to Politiciano, both of you. And when you grow old to dream, you will have no one to remember you because you hated anybody who was different. So Zena and Phobia sailed back to Politiciano, and as their boat entered the harbor, they saw hundreds of people on the pier, people who they were told were escaping from what they now called the Island of Hate. And they were following Cara and Mio, who had finally realized they needed to seek a life of love away from Zena and Phobia in Politiciano. So, can you think of anything that... You can explain it to your parents later. But can you think of anything that there's a lesson in that story? Would it be... Yes, love.
It doesn't matter if you're different.
Sorry?
It doesn't matter if you're different.
Yeah, exactly. Look, good girl. Very good. Well, listen, thank you all. And Katie and Elaine are doing the children's Sunday school downstairs, if you would like to go down. Our second reading... is from this wonderful book, The Poetry Pharmacy, which I'm sure many people know. And this very short poem I'm going to read is called Scintillate, and it's by Roger McGough. But before that, there's a little sort of explanation. And I know it doesn't apply to too many people here, but there are some of us. Acknowledging the end of one's youthful vitality can be a very difficult adjustment. Yet there comes a point at which it is simply impossible to keep up with the younger generation. Take me. Even if I had the will or the interest to keep up with Generation Z's fashion and music, I know better than to deceive myself that they would want me to. The sad thing, though, is that as we older folk lose our energy, we can often lose our confidence along with it. We may think that we've lost not only our youthfulness, but also our usefulness, our power to entertain and inspire. And if we are no longer the life and soul of the party, we ask ourselves, why should we be invited at all? Meanwhile, life's more visceral pleasures begin to dwindle. We are settled down, we're responsible, and acutely aware of the possibility of a three-day hangover. This is where this charming poem by Roger McGough comes in, reminding us in wonderfully witty terms that it is never too late to be a little wild. Yes, perhaps our energies are dwindling. Perhaps we are at our happiest tucked in with a hot water bottle by the 6 o'clock news. But there are plenty of hours in the day. And with a little creativity, it's possible to pack a staggering amount of excitement in before an early bedtime. There is no shame in slowing down. But there is a great deal of pride to be found in having fun on one's own terms. Now the poem, Scintillate by Roger McGough. I have outlived my youthfulness, so a quiet life for me, where once I used to scintillate, now I sin till 3:10. the poetry pharmacy. Let us be grateful for all that we have. Let us be grateful for where we live. Let us be grateful for the opportunity to come to this church, not by compulsion, but to come when we feel we need to and want to. And let us be grateful for this wonderful community, a people of many, many different experiences and backgrounds, who have grown to love each other and to see how different people can bring so much to a unity of purpose. And of course, the unity of purpose of this church is that we shall have a spiritual path which suits each of us individually. We are taught, of course, never to judge others. As the saying goes, there is so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us that it ill behoves any of us to talk about the rest of us. And also, we've been enjoined throughout our lives not to cast the first stone. But surely there comes a time, and it could be in these months and years, when casting a few stones and judging others is a necessity for Western civilization, such as it is, if nothing else. Bob Riley, a retired US Republican politician, said that tolerating evil leads only to more evil. And when good people stand by and do nothing while wickedness reigns, their communities will be consumed. The well-known US psychologist Philip Zimbardo says, bullies may be perpetrators of evil, but it is the evil of passivity of all those who know what is happening and never intervene that perpetuates such abuse. They both, of course, were following on from Edmund Burke, who, as we know, famously said that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. The background, indeed, to this talk is the seeming widespread public view that evil is triumphing, is trumping good, that there is more suffering and pain and that globally, besides cruel wars, which we don't need to go into, minorities are under monstrous pressure. Small ethnic and religious groups, the poor, immigrants, LGBT people, are being harassed and squeezed by religious fundamentalists, big tech business, powerful despotic government, and the far right. There is a gathering cruelty in the air. Caroline Mace tells us that evil is real. In her book, The Courage to Confront Evil, she says evil is a real, continuous force, just like there is a conscious force of good. We think, she says, that we have abolished evil. Indeed, people are comfortable with the idea of angels, but not of demons. But there are demonic forces, and these are real, are messages of darkness. Mace says that while she has never been around a demon, she has a high sense of when she is near this darkness, of when she is near people whose only intent is to corrupt those around them, to diminish their self-worth, to take possession of them in some way. This, she says, is a form of evil. Richard Rohr, who many of us know, R-O-H-R, as part of his daily meditations, writes that we are still quite capable of full complicity in deeds of death. Governments, religions, and corporations are all highly capable of evil while not recognizing it as such, because it profits us for them to be immoral. If, he says, we don't see the shape of evil or recognize how we are fully complicit in it, it will control us while not looking the least like sin. The beginning of the way out from evil, he concludes, is to honestly see what we are doing. And the mature religion must, quotes, train us to recognize the many camouflages of evil. So, of course, it is vital before we try to tackle evil that we are clear about what it is, and that we remember, in regard to evil, pain, and suffering, and character, almost always, as Peter Vardy says in his book, The Puzzle of Evil, black is mixed with white, or at least grey. Vardy says that even Hitler, who did malevolently wicked things, had his good points, transforming a war-torn country after World War I. Franco, he writes, was vilified, but his officials saved more Jews in World War II than did the French government under Pétain. And he goes on to talk about Guy Fawkes and Oliver Cromwell, who, he says, while he brought democracy to England, was in many ways an ill-mannered murderer, which I think we know. Indeed, this issue of the complexity of seemingly wicked characters has arisen in our courts. Some years ago, a soldier was convicted of a heinous sex crime. Before sentence, an officer told the court that the defendant was a courteous, good soldier. This, I believe, was what he was obliged to do, so that the judge could have a rounded view of the defendant before him. The officer was outlining his experience of the soldier independently of the evidence given in court. But this didn't discourage condemnation of the officer, whose critics did not understand the nature of character evidence, or indeed one's maybe Christian or human duty to outline whatever goodness was in the guilty soldier. And many of us, of course, will be familiar with Hannah Arendt's report, The Banality of Evil, on the 1960s Israeli trial of Adolf Eichmann for genocide. Hannah Arendt was trying to analyze why a seemingly mild-mannered man could have perpetrated such monstrous crimes. She decided that the evil done was because ordinary men wanted to obey orders. Above all, they prized bureaucratic efficiency. What had become banal, she said, was the failure to think, the consequences of which could be genocide. The indictment of Eichmann went beyond the man to a world in which true thinking, she said, had vanished, as might be increasingly apparent today. The consequence was that crimes against humanity became thinkable. Like Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, she also criticized the concept of collective guilt. Where those personally innocent during the Nazi era admitted to collective guilt, while the real criminals showed no remorse. To Hannah Arendt's dismay, Eichmann said that he was acting from obedience, a precept he said he had taken from Immanuel Kant. For Arendt, this was outrageous, as Kant's moral philosophy was bound up with the man's faculty of judgment, which rules out blind obedience. For Kant, every man is a legislator the moment he starts to act, which I think is a very profound statement. Evil is complicated, therefore, as is pain and suffering, of which more later. And throughout the centuries, well before the Common Era, thinkers have sought to define what it is and how it arises. In one definition, for example, it is that which works against the welfare of humankind or the purpose of a benevolent God. In another, we are told that moral evil is due to the deliberate act of human beings who, with free will, choose to be less than God intended. For others, evil is the fault of demons let loose upon the world because of the hubris of man or the rebellion against God by disgruntled angels. And when we look back the centuries at what various cultures believed about evil, a perennial question was why an omniscient God, an omnipotent God, and even omnidevelopment benevolent God would allow evil, both moral and natural, when he could prevent it. For the ancient Greeks, all things came from the gods, so they were the sources of evil as well as of good. The existence of evil, pain, and suffering was accepted simply as part of the inscrutable will of the god Zeus. And after the Golden Age, these evils only entered the world when they escaped from the famous box brought by the first woman, Pandora. Like that other woman, Eve, Pandora ended the golden age of mankind. In her case, when she disobeyed Zeus and out of curiosity opened the box, releasing all the evils and miseries of the world. As Albert Reynolds famously said, that's women for you. Or as Adam said, pointing at Eve, it was her that did it. For Aristotle, if there is good, there has to be evil. The absence of the good in any pair of contraries is always negative in relation to the other. Darkness is the absence of light, etc. Epicurus, who lived around till about 270 BCE, is credited with formulating a riddle. If God is willing to prevent evil, but not able, then he is not omnipotent. If he is able, but not willing to prevent evil, then he is malevolent. This was followed up later by the Scottish philosopher David Hume. For the believer, in the broadest sense, it is a question which continuously arises and which may never be resolved satisfactorily. While for many non-believers, it is further proof that such a being as God does not exist. Irenaeus accepted God's partial responsibility for evil. Human beings are imperfect creatures who must be made perfect by development and growth. Evil is a means to an end, and the world with its mingled good and evil is part of God's plan. Augustine followed this with amendments. For him, good is a substance which is ultimately most expressed in God. But evil is no substance. It is a perversion of the will, a turning aside from God. He distinguishes between moral evil and natural evil, his views on the latter causing problems for many thoughtful Christians. For him, moral evil is a privation or lack, while natural evil, like earthquakes, pain, illness, is an outworking of God's perfect creation, which could also be seen as a punishment for sin. Augustine rejected the idea that there are equal evil and good powers at work in the universe, saying that all substances are good, even the flames of hell, because they come from God. And God has no responsibility for the existence of moral evil. That is the fault of myself and yourself, who misuse the gift we have been given. Anything, according to Augustine, that departs from its being, that is not what it should be, is to that extent evil. Like the man who does not fulfill the nature that God had intended for him. Thomas Aquinas follows this view. While moral evil is due to the deliberate acts of those who have free will and are choosing to be less than intended, natural evil is part of God's creation, caused incidentally as part of nature. For instance, a disease that causes great pain. It is only from our perspective, not God's, that we see this as evil. And God, says Aquinas, has no moral obligations to the creatures that he creates. Such what might be termed callousness may offend many people, although there is a view that if God could prevent all pain and suffering, it would take away our freedom. Another belief called the Great Controversy that percolates to this day comes from the Seventh-day Adventists. Satan became discontented with God's laws, led a rebellion, and was expelled from heaven. The field of battle continues to this day. And then it shifted to the earth, where Satan infected Adam and Eve with the same pride. Zoroastrianism in ancient Persia had a somewhat similar view, envisaging the world as a scene of struggle between light and darkness. And so we come to Adam and Eve, the story of their creation and disobedience having had huge influence on Western thought. Women, according to Mary Condren, have been identified with Eve, the symptom of our negative nature, the depths to which we can sink if we are not faithful to our religious heritage, and woman can only attain sanctity by identifying with the Virgin Mary, who was conceived without sin. So, in one view, the world is a battle between good and evil, in some way limiting the omnipotence of God. Our God is a despot. What he wills is right because he is God. As expressed by the Swiss theologian Karl Barth, who refused to discuss the problem of evil. If God is God, he said, how can we dispute his wisdom in making things as they are? If God decrees that this man shall be saved and this one damned, this is just because he is God. But in contrast to the view that God is absolute and the other view that he is subject to limitations, there stands the mediating view that God's power is limited only by his own character of righteousness, truth, and love. This is a stance which might sit more easily with many Christians and God believers in Unitarianism, who might agree with some of the following. One, that in creating mankind, God desired to bring into existence beings who could freely choose the true, the beautiful, and the good. One that opposes the belief that God allows evil and suffering so human beings can be free to enter a two-way love relationship with him. One that does not accept natural evils, earthquakes, suffering, etc., as an inevitable byproduct of God's aim of developing souls and moral character. One that believes, like Ivan Karasmov in Dostoevsky's novel, that the suffering of innocent children can never be justified by some eventual end our purpose planned by God. One that takes on view the views of some Jewish theologians, that Christians do not take seriously enough the theology of suffering, and demand that any theology should be capable of being undertaken in the presence of burning children. One that agrees that the church has harped too much on sin. As Leslie Weatherhead says, in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus used the noun only on 6 occasions and the verb on 3. St. Paul, however, seemed obsessed with sin, using the word 91 times. One that accepts that Leslie Weatherhead's criticism of the old Anglican baptism that said all men are conceived and born in sin. One that agrees with the optimistic view of Francis Hutcheson, father of the Scottish Enlightenment, born in County Down, who Fergus has discussed with us a number of times, that people are born with what might be called a clean slate. They are not motivated by self-interest or human gain. Or one that believes that there is evil in the world which must be confronted. Or that agrees with Caroline Mace that evil is manifesting itself more now because we have decided it does not exist, and that gives it free rein. Are some that, like Richard Rohr, asks, how much are we complicit in the evil deeds of large corporations because it profits us for them to be immoral? And we could ask, what are we doing today, maybe only half realizing it, that facilitates evil? Charging what the market will bear for goods and services rather than a fair price. Ignoring tax avoidance by those who work for us. Jumping the medical queue because of our financial clout. And to the detriment of young couples seeking houses, lobbying against planning applications for spurious and selfish reasons. I've been guilty of at least one or two of those activities, some would say evils, which, as Caroline Mace puts it in the broader context, we have decided do not exist. She is right, I think, when she says our most important choice now is to get our conscience up and running as soon as we can. Amen. Our third hymn, number 207, Earth Was Given as a Garden. Our notices, there will be a management committee meeting tomorrow at 7:30 on Zoom. Pam's reflection meditation service will be at lunch hour, of course, as usual on Wednesday. And straight after the service, there's a meeting of the Damer and Singleton committee. And Bridget has asked me to say that in the Belfast churches on Good Friday, they are going to read the names of all those who were murdered during the Troubles. Thank you to so many people, to Chris for a fine reading, Josh as ever, and the wonderful Amos trio, our welcomers Emer and Gronja, and Emer of course for the flowers, and of course most important Madeline, Paula and Andrew, who will be providing us with a mug of tea or a half a cup of coffee downstairs. To which, by the way, everybody is welcome. And to thank also Katie and Elaine for doing the Children's Club. And finally, our last hymn, 346, Come Sing a Song With Me. Let us leave this sacred space with love in our hearts to help counteract any evil we encounter. Help us, in the words of Caroline Mace, to get our consciences up and running, to encourage us to become aware that we may be at least somewhat complicit in the evils of large entities because their activities profit us. And until we meet again, may God hold you and yours in the palm of his hand. Thank you.